Starwalker Studios presents GM Intrusions, the podcast devoted to Numenera and the strange.
Hello everyone, and welcome to episode 16 of GM Intrusions, the podcast devoted to Numenera and the strange. I'm your host, Lex Starwalker. Darcy Ross joins me again today to talk all about the Beale of Borregaal. This is one of the adventures included in the Numenera core book. So grab your dice and get ready to spend some effort. It's time for a GM Intrusion.
Under the Lens, the Cipher System.
So Darcy is joining us again today, and we're going to talk about running one-shots of Numenera, among other things. So welcome back to the show, Darcy.
Thank you so much. I'm glad to be back on.
Yeah, it's great to have you. You're my first returning guest, hopefully
yes.
First of many.
I'm sure.
Maybe you could start out telling us a little bit about your experiences as a new Numenera GM and how it went for you starting out.
Yeah, absolutely. So new Numenera GM as well as like first time GM period. So
a lot
of learning has occurred. But what I found is that I've run the Nightmare Switch 3 times and then the Beale of Borregaal once.
Okay.
And the pre-written adventures are fantastic. I always felt pretty comfortable being able to, grasp the plot, grasp the core rules, and really spend my time getting good detail in, really working with the story and where my players were taking it. So I felt like I had an easier time than I expected, sort of getting each of my one shots on the road.
Oh, cool.
Which was
awesome.
Nice. Yeah.
Yeah, that's. I was kind of curious. I really like the adventures and how they're written, but it's nice to hear from someone who's a new GM. I didn't realize that you hadn't GM'd other games before. That was news to me.
Yeah, very fresh.
Well, cool. Very cool. So, which was the first one that you ran?
So I ran the Nightmare Switch as my first one, and I was sort of between running the Nightmare Switch or the Vortex, which I got to play at Gen Con. So the Vortex looks great too, and I haven't run it yet, but it is sort of built like a two-parter, and I was running it for a lot of different people and groups cobbled together, so I really wanted to have a short one session run of Numenera to have a full story during. So I went with the Nightmare Switch, which is a lot shorter, and I went with the Beale, which is, I was lucky that I was able to cram it into one session, but I feel like it would probably have benefited from a two-parter as well. I don't know if that was your experience, but.
Yeah. So I ran the Beale of Borregaal for my wife. So she was the only player, and it was the one time I got her to play Numenera and try it out. And I think we did it over 2 or 3 sessions. So definitely kind of long for a one shot, unless you have a really long gaming session.
Yeah, it took us 5 hours. And I was lucky that they sort of took a path that skipped a bunch of it. And I cut out a number of parts of it, but it did work out. And the flavor, I think, was very good for a first introduction to Numenera. I thought it was very weird and had a lot of like cool culture that really brought the players into the world, which I appreciated.
Well, before we get into that adventure specifically, what has been your experience as a new GM running Numenera? Have you found it fairly easy to run it, or have you had any challenges with it?
So I've been probably poring over these adventures almost too much. So I usually, you know, they're written very well and very not railroady. So I was able to make it at least not feel railroady to my players. But what I really struggled with is combat, making combat interesting. You know, I'm used to Dungeons and Dragons or something like that, where combat is primarily a numbers game and you want to defeat the monster to get the experience. And, you know, the mechanics kind of run it. Whereas I felt like it was a little boring. Like, I could have done better about spicing up the combat and keeping that narratively driven as well. Which I think I could do much better now that I have the bestiary. Like, that has been awesome for giving me inspiration on how to keep it weird and still narrative, because the goal isn't to just, you know, kill the monster. It's you know, this broader scene. So.
Right. Okay. Yeah. So one thing that I've been trying to do is to have the players actually do as much work as possible, which is really cool that you can even do that in this game. Like, you know, sometimes if they have something, letting them describe, like if they get a major or a minor effect or something like that, or having them, you know, if the nano uses an esoteric, have them describe, you know, what that looks like.
I love doing that. I've started to implement that, and I definitely wish I had done it earlier. Letting the players do the work, they get so into it. Like, players I mostly played with people who've never played RPGs, and they still took to it really well. Like, especially when they, you know, rolled those 19-20s, and I let them describe, you know, their major success.
Yeah.
It's worked really well for me too.
Yeah, totally. And you know, part of making a character in Numenera is kind of figuring out how you do what you do. Like, if you're a nano and you have some of the more crazy abilities, you know, you can figure out, well, am I doing this through nanites, or do I have some kind of genetic, like I'm telepathic or something?
Right.
And a lot of players spend a lot of time like fleshing all that out. And so that's a great way to let them kind of bring it into the story, because as I'm sure you know, Darcy, as a GM, we have a lot to think about and keep in our heads at once. And
yes,
it's very easy for us to forget these cool things that the players came up with for their characters kind of in the rush of combat. So I love that we can just kind of let them describe it and then we just roll with it.
Definitely. So that's worked really well, but I still need to sort of up my game in what the enemy combatants do to the players. You know, I had them fighting some, you know, broken hounds, and I was like, I guess the broken hound bites you again. And so I think, having read the bestiary, I've gotten more creative with like GM intrusions I can run and keeping that more flavorful too. But my players have been doing really well at keeping it pretty cinematic. So that is definitely a testament to how the game, what the game lends itself to.
Well, I think you're very lucky to get to start GMing with Numenera, because I've run some other games that are a lot more difficult just because the mechanics are so much more involved and there's so many rules that you have to know as a GM. And yeah, you should try running Pathfinder sometime.
I feel so spoiled now, because I've always wanted to run these other games, and now I'm just, you know, I look at the rules section and I just sigh, and I'm like, oh, but this could be so much more streamlined, and I just, you know, I want the setting and not the rules that come with it. And so I'm looking forward to The Strange, so I can just shove all of these great settings I want to play into the Cypher system and still be able to cheat my way through GMing.
Now, I think I saw on Twitter earlier that you're playing the Dresden Files. Is that right?
Yeah, I'm actually in a Dresden Files Fate game right now.
Yeah, so I haven't actually played a Fate game, but I've kind of read over the system, and it looks very cool. It looks like that would be another good system to cut your teeth on as a new GM.
Yeah, that would be. I'm playing in it right now, but it's very it's like narratively driven as well, but it's very mechanicsy.
Okay.
In weird ways, like the aspects that I haven't fully grasped. I feel like Numenera was easier for me to quickly pick up on.
Okay.
But yeah, it's a great system, and I'm trying to learn more about the deeper workings of it as well.
Awesome. So we're going to talk about the Beal of Borregaal today, right? That's mm-hmm. what we're doing. And we may have Darcy back to talk about some of the other adventures that she runs. I was looking over this today because I did run it once for my wife, but I wanted to kind of freshen up on it. And I saw in the core book, right before they get into the actual adventures, they kind of have a little synopsis of each one. And it said that this is intended for a GM for their first session, for someone who's never run Numenera before, which was you, Darcy.
Definitely.
So do you feel it was a good adventure to introduce you and the players to Numenera and the system and everything?
Certainly. It was, I didn't prepare for it as much as I probably should have. So it was a little chaotic, on my part. And what was nice is that I think the way it's structured, even though I didn't really do my homework like I should have, it flowed well, and the players, you know, it felt very, it didn't feel as disjointed as it certainly should have, because I hadn't done my homework. So I think it's a very forgiving adventure. And yeah, I think it's got great flavor, and good bits of culture and fun lingo that they throw in. And so I think that really drew in my players and got them really engaged in the setting. So I think it's definitely, I would definitely run it again for first time players to Numenera.
Awesome. And one thing that I really liked about it is on the first page of the adventure, it has a, what would you call it? Kind of a map of the flow of the plot,
yeah,
of the different encounters. And it kind of shows you, you know, at this point, you know, the PCs can either go to encounter A or encounter B, and it kind of maps out the flow of the story. And if you're a new GM, like, that's a great thing to do for any adventure that you run. Just kind of make a, what do they call it? Like a mind web or something like that?
Yeah, a flowchart mind web, I guess, since it goes different ways. Yeah. I thought that was really helpful, and I might be wrong, but I think in my PDF of it, I don't know if it's ever updated, some of the arrows are incorrect though. So, I mean, once you read the adventure, it becomes obvious, but like some of the arrows are like pointing the wrong direction or just have been flipped. So that's just sort of something to watch out for if you're about to run it in my PDF anyway.
Oh, like, wow.
Yeah. The one where you leave Silean Basin, it says, you know, basically the arrows going to sort of the final location, they're swapped on the wrong side. It's not a big deal because it still shows you the different encounters and how each numbered encounter flows to the next one. So I think that's the most important part, but there's a little bit of a typo there, I think. So watch out for that.
Okay. Well, they either fix that in the actual print book, or I just didn't notice that the arrow was going the wrong way, which is equally possible.
Yeah, certainly.
Well, Darcy, how do you want to do this? I'll kind of leave it up to you because you have far more experience with this adventure than I do. So what would you like to talk about first?
Yeah. Would you mind if I just chatted about sort of how I set up, like, before the adventure started, because I think there are some tricks that if you're running for a new group, I sort of figured out some tricks that really helped for running a one shot with people completely new to Numenera. So
yeah. Awesome.
Like,
that sounds,
you know,
great.
I sent you that, sort of cheat sheet thing that I came up with. That Riley Vandal actually came up with and sent me, and I've sort of modified. So that's been really helpful as a first time GM as well. So it's a cheat sheet that has either the pre-gens or spaces for character names, types, foci, and descriptors, and then a space for the player names. And so once people had their characters set up, I run it both with pre-gens from the Vortex and let people create characters beforehand or sort of finish creating them at the time, which is what I did for Beal.
Okay.
And shockingly, that worked in a one-shot setting.
Nice.
So I think, yeah, I was really surprised. I was like, oh no, we're going to spend all night here creating characters. But obviously Numenera character creation is really quick. So I'm really impressed to see that that worked within the time frame of a one shot. And so it's not something to shy away from, shockingly, as long as people sort of know what foci are out there before they come.
Yeah.
So I did that. And then once people have their characters, I sort of went around and filled in this cheat sheet of, you know, John is Vera, a, you know, a sneaky Jack who fights with panache or whatever. And and it was just nice to sort of introduce everyone to their, you know, actual, who the actual person is and sort of what the composition of the party is. And I also had them read their character connection without having assigned it to anyone. And so after everyone had been introduced, they sort of fed back and forth and decided how they were all related. And that little time period is that little discussion was awesome in setting up the feel of the game and getting people in character and sort of helping flesh out the characters really well before the adventure even started, which was really nice to have a sort of quick way to have good role-playing experiences during a one-shot. So I thought that was like something I'm always going to do, is sort of do this slow go around, introduce and connect for all of my one-shots. I think that was really helpful. And you know, I always pull out the world map before I start and really try to, you know, set them in the context of Numenera, the, you know, the ninth world, and sort of show them where they are on the map and what's around. And people really got into that as well. So I'm always pulling that map out, which I have to, like, you know, frame or something soon to keep it intact. And I think that's it for what I really did to set up. But I thought that was really important for pulling the characters together before I even started. So.
Yeah, those character connections are so great. It just, even if, you know, your players end up doing something totally different, it just, it kind of gets that conversation started of, you know, how are we all connected together?
Yeah.
It's so much better than you all just happen to be in a bar together when X happens.
Right. And I saw that, like, those little details, like, characters, people brought them up later in game. You know, they sort of rationalized why these two characters worked together on this event. And, oh, it was because we shared a mentor at this institution. Like, people really got way more into it than I thought they would, especially for being new to RPGs. So I think it's incredibly effective.
Yeah, and some of them even have, like, tactical applications. For instance, Rides of the Lightning, at some point you get the ability to basically kind of teleport or travel through electricity, and you can have a connection with someone in the group where you can actually take them with you, where normally you can't take anyone with you.
Oh, right, yeah.
And so, you know, even, you know, at sixth tier or something way down the road, you know, that could actually come into play in some kind of tactical situation where you can save the day because you can actually take this person with you.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, I'm still getting through the core book. I still haven't read every single page in the core book. And I was reading some of the chapters at the very end where it's giving kind of more advanced GM advice for running the game. And I saw in there that the first two chapters of the core book are intended to, well, I believe the first chapter introduces the players to the setting, and then the second chapter is a brief rundown of how the rules work. So that's something else you can use if you're starting with brand new players, is kind of go over those two chapters with them. And I think that's really brilliant that the book was written that way. So you can take a new player and say, hey, just read. And like chapter one is like 2 pages.
Yeah.
And chapter two is like 4 pages. So it won't even take them very long to read it. And
absolutely.
Yeah.
I actually just ordered another copy of the player's guide, which has some of those, has those first, you know, 3 chapters or whatever in them, because it's so useful to just sort of hand out before I run a one shot, you know, just, if you don't read anything else, which I, you know, most people didn't, read that first two pages to get a feel for what you're getting into. And so I love what they've done with that in that front matter.
So when you ran Numenera, did any of your players have the player's guide or the core book?
Not beforehand, but a number of them, I'm very happy to say, have acquired them following. So awesome. Especially during that sale they had on the Monte Cook Games store.
Yeah. I'd love the player's guide. It's just so brilliant. You know, it's like, hey, you don't have to buy this really expensive hardback book if you're a player. You can just buy this cheaper softcover book and kind of have what you need to get you hooked on the game.
Yeah, absolutely.
All right, everybody. At this point in the conversation, we start to get a little spoilery on the BL of Borregaal. So if you are a player and you think it's possible you may be playing this adventure in the future, you probably don't want to listen to the rest of this conversation because there will be some spoilers in it for you. But if you're a GM and you're wanting to run this adventure, then stay tuned and hopefully you'll find some interesting and helpful tidbits. Darcy, do you want to tell us kind of the setup for the story?
Sure.
Know it better than I do.
Vaguely. I think the little synopsis they have on the beginning of that adventure sums it up pretty well. So I'll sort of paraphrase that because, you know, I was trying to summarize it to myself earlier and just tying myself into confusion because my players were coming up with all these crazy ideas about how different parts of the adventure were related in ways that were not intended. So it was this sort of meta plot that they came up with. But the core of it was that there's this out in the beyond on the Wandering Walk where mysterious pilgrims walk around on this path that may circle the whole ninth world for whatever reason. There's a town called Embered Peaks, and it's in this little mountain range, and the Aeon priests there found a machine that has the ability to restore dead brain cells to life for a brief period of time, basically long enough just to ask one question. And after experimentation with this marvelous device, they eventually found out that the answer is always a lie for whatever reason, and so it was sort of this resurrection machine that people would come far and wide to sort of see. And the Aeon priests there started experimenting to see whether they couldn't use it to restore the brain cells back to life for longer and sort of, you know, actually turn it into a fully fledged resurrection machine. And it wakes up the entity that is sort of powering it, which is a... So this is all going to be spoilers, right?
Yeah, we're okay. In the spoiler section.
We are in the spoiler section. Okay, so the entity beneath was once a man named Borregaal, who had a Beal, which is a genetic mutation that allows him to touch the minds of others telepathically. And, you know, he was a really powerful one and was really ostracized, and so he hid himself away in this little prison machine thing that he's in and sort of went quiet, asleep, and maybe a little awake and mad over the years. And so he's being awoken, and he doesn't know what's going on, and he's reaching out with his Beal, and sort of, you know, he's sort of driven mad, and so he's reaching out and trying to touch anyone who's around, and this has upset the wildlife of the area, sort of driven them a little insane, and it's pulling people with Beals of their own toward him for whatever reason, trying to help him, I guess. And so he's sort of, as he wakes up more and more, he's driving the town around him totally insane, as he's, you know, tinkering with their minds. And so there's all this chaos happening at Embered Peaks, and the players who start out a ways away on the Wandering Walk are seeing the effects of this chaos in the Silean Basin, another town they visit, and you know, just sort of the local area where wildlife's going insane and, you know, some people are being affected and being driven toward this, you know, source in the Embered Peaks. And so they sort of follow this line of clues and can choose to help Borregaal or kill him or you know, there's a lot of ways this adventure could end. So yeah. That's still skipping a lot of it because it can be a very, you know, long adventure if you played it that way.
Yeah. So the adventure starts assuming that the players are walking this wandering walk pilgrimage for some reason. And it gives quite a few examples of why they could be doing that. But if you have any player that has any kind of like telepathic ability, that gives you a really good hook right there. Because like you were saying, Borogal is kind of reaching out with his mind, and anybody sensitive to that could be lured into that area. Mm-hmm. Through, I think the way I did it with my wife is she was having some strange dreams that kind of drew her to the area. She wasn't actually telepathic, but she had the talks to machines focus.
Oh, okay.
That so works. I kind of went that route with it. But I just want to talk about the Wandering Walk for a second because I just really... this was the first adventure I read for Numenera, and the Wandering Walk just really grabbed my imagination. And it's also really cool because if you want to use this adventure as like a starting off point for a longer campaign, it's perfect for that because you can just say, oh, you know, you guys, for whatever your reason is, you're traveling along this pilgrimage, and this is just one of the adventures you have on your journey. And I love Numenera because they don't actually tell you very much about the Wandering Walk.
Right.
It's kind of up to you to figure out, you know, why is it there and what's the deal and where does it even go? Mm. I like the idea that they presented, which is that it goes around the ninth world and kind of in a circle. Which at first I thought like it was going around the globe, but then I remembered that in the ninth world, everything's like one big supercontinent. So it just kind of...
Oh, you're right.
Yeah, so maybe it just goes around the circumference of that or something. But it'd be a great way to... If you kind of wanted to have one of those adventures where every week the players are in some new exotic setting, this would be a great way to do that.
That's a fantastic point. So none of my players ended up being telepathic either, but, you know, I had it that, you know, some Aeon priest wanted them to investigate rumors of the resurrection machine, and also hopefully, you know, his naturalist interests. They wanted to see the, what was it? It was the little light swarms of the area, which is an encounter that can happen on the Wandering Walk. And unfortunately, I didn't have any time to run any of the cool, you know, interspersed Wandering Walk encounters because there were a bunch of really good ones.
Yeah.
Were you able to run any of them?
Let's see. So the bioluminescent swarms.
Yeah.
Which it's like these little translucent creatures. It doesn't really describe them. I kind of pictured them as maybe insect-sized creatures. That like light up as they do this like mating dance or something. I didn't actually run that encounter with my wife. I don't remember why. I did. We weren't really pressed for time, so I did a lot of the other ones. Mm-hmm. The one I was kind of iffy about was I think it's called a Zalem.
Yeah.
Which was this like slug-like creature that like would eat people and things and deposit them on these big like bulges on its back. Right. And there could even be like ciphers in these bulges. Yeah. So if you hit it, like a cipher could explode or something. which that was really cool, but the way the encounter with that starts is you see this thing in the distance and you think it's like a band of bandits.
Yeah.
And I just personally I had a hard time imagining how this thing could be mistaken for a band of bandits because they would all be moving kind of in unison. And so I kind of had a hard time describing that to my wife in what I felt was a convincing manner.
Yeah.
Did you do that encounter?
So I started it and they thought it was just bandits. And so they ignored it. but I didn't really want to run it that much because I didn't think I'd really have time. Mm-hmm. And so I didn't really say bandits. I said, armored folk. And, the way I was sort of imagining it is, it's like a weird setup, for an animal, I guess, but, so it's eating these. So I kind of thought of it as like maybe a really, really long slug with like multi-chambered stomachs. And as it eats these people, it sort of regurgitates the armor and the undigestibles up on top of its little hump on top of each like stomach. And so it would be this like, sort of sticking up chunk of armor in a couple spots on its body. So I could kind of see if it undulated, it might look like people walking.
Yeah. Okay.
But so you could tweak it to kind of make it work, but it's a very weird concept. So it's even challenging to GM things that are that weird sometimes.
Yeah, but I guess it is a great way to kind of show your players kind of the weird of the world and show them that, who knows what you might encounter.
Oh, it could absolutely
be anything. Yeah, and there are enough of these kind of random encounters thrown in that you don't have to do them all if you don't want to. There's enough that you could pick a few of them that you really like and just do those if you want.
Yeah, it's very modular in parts. And I was lucky that, there's this whole section of the flowchart that you could go to where, you go help the little Aldea in the False Woods.
Right.
And the party just wanted to help this girl, Sierra, and mm-hmm. were more interested in her. And so they sort of gave this impassioned speech to the other people hiding out in the Mouth Carn along the Wandering Path walk. And they gave this impassioned speech, and they basically convinced everyone who was there to go help the town so that they could get over to the more interesting bit of Silean Basin and Embered Peaks.
Oh, so that's a good way to handle
it. They skipped all of it. It was perfect, yeah.
Yeah, that's really funny because my wife actually skipped that too.
Oh, did she? Interesting. Yeah,
but I don't remember her. She was just like, screw them. They're on their own.
Nice.
Yeah, and that was actually kind of that moment was, this was the first time I ran Numenera, and that moment was kind of an eye-opener for me. Because I've run a lot of D&D and Pathfinder in the past, and I'm used to this idea of alignment. And like you have this alignment that you're like a slave to. And when she did that, there was this part of me that was like, oh, well, she shouldn't do that. She's whatever alignment, and that's this alignment. And then I was like, wait a minute, none of that matters. She can do whatever the hell she wants.
No, that's a great point.
Yeah, and it's kind of funny because I've listened to some an actual play podcast where the party is very, like in D&D terms, they would be like a neutral or chaotic evil party, and they're
one is that?
It's called Roleplay Idiots.
Interesting. Okay.
And yeah, I didn't actually recommend them on my last podcast where I recommend an actual play podcast just because it's a really fun podcast, but the GM kind of runs the game his own way. So he doesn't actually, as far as like how he uses the system, it's not like really correct. Like he has them like adding bonuses to their rolls instead of lowering target number and stuff like that. It totally works, but if you're new to the game, it might confuse you if you don't already have a good grasp on the system.
Right.
But it's a lot of fun because they're, I think they're like Australian and British and I'm not sure what all. So lots of interesting accents.
Ooh,
and I think a couple of them might be actually intentionally doing accents for their characters, but it's pretty hilarious. But they're like, definitely not like good aligned, hero type characters, but it's just hilarious to see what they do with the stories. They actually did the Beal of Borregaal.
Oh, did they?
Yeah, that was like their first episode. They did that, and it was pretty hilarious. They ended up basically being chased out of town.
Oh God.
Because they killed some people, but...
Oh, gosh. Wow.
What else do you have to say about this adventure, Darcy?
Yeah, so there's combat that could happen, but the only real combat that my players had was in the Synth Garden with the Broken Hounds. And it sort of went... did you run that for your wife?
Yeah, it was pretty cut and dry, though.
Yeah, that's how I ran mine, and I really... My players didn't think anything of it because it was their first combat, so they were like, you know, I think afraid for their lives. So they like have this, you know, elaborate like strategy, and you know, they were, you know, had their tanks in front and, you know, everybody in back, and so they had a really easy time of it, and it was just sort of, you know, the dog attacks and then a couple more come from behind and the Broken Hound attacks again, and it wasn't that interesting, and I think I could have made it a lot more interesting, but they seemed to be satisfied enough with it. One thing I saw in the bestiary that I would definitely put back in if I were to run this again is, so the warder, which is a monster in the bestiary, is sort of dog-like. I was like flipping through looking for sort of quadrupeds and maybe some GM intrusions on how to make them more interesting as an assailant.
Yeah.
And, they had a GM intrusion where the warder comes up and, latches onto a player's arm and you have to shake him off, and then you have, lowered speed defense rolls for a couple turns. And so that would have been a way to make it sort of a little more interesting, sort of with combat-wise. And also, when I ran it with six players, they are so hard to kill. I can be so much meaner than I've been being, you know?
Oh, yeah.
Six players is like, with, you know, six different foci, it's, you know, your players are way more powerful than I intuitively think.
Well, as you know, I've been running the Devil's Spine, and we have four players right now. And I mean, I don't really know from moment to moment like what people's pools are at, because I just let them keep track of that. And I really have no idea where they're at. But I don't think I've yet had someone even go down the damage track at all. Characters are definitely more powerful starting out in this game than other games I've played.
Yeah.
Which I actually like, because it kind of takes away that drive to like grow in power. You know, if you play like, say, D&D or Pathfinder, you start out as a level one wizard and it's like you're so fragile and there's so little you can do, and you're just so motivated to just go up as many levels as quickly as you can so you can do cool things. And I think it really fits the spirit of this game that you start out being able to do cool things so you can kind of just chill out and enjoy the story and not worry about it.
Or if you're worrying about it, it's because something like really epic and cinematic happened. You know, you're going down the damage track, poison is coming out and explosions. You know, you have to have more creative encounters to get really scared, I think, which is good.
Yeah, and that's something else about the system that I really like, is how you have both this, you know, where you're just taking kind of normal damage and you're losing points from your pools, but then you also have the damage track.
Right.
And like in the bestiary, it talks about, you know, if you want to make a monster really scary, have it have some attack that just puts you down the damage track and doesn't even do regular damage. And
right.
Suddenly your the pucker factor goes way up.
Absolutely.
If you're the kind of GM that you look through an adventure and you look for ways to kind of make it your own, when I ran it, I felt like the only real weak point in the adventure was the Broken Hound thing.
Yeah.
Because it felt almost kind of EverQuest or WoW like, because it's like you need this thing and you go to this old lady and she's like, oh well, before I'll help you, you must go to this garden and kill 10 broken hounds, you know?
Yep.
Just like one of those quests in those video games. And yeah, the hounds themselves weren't terribly weird.
Yeah.
So you could, like Darcy said, you know, find some cooler creature from the bestiary to just use instead, and that would probably help a lot.
Yeah, and it did feel odd, especially because surrounding it, like Silean Basin and the lady who sends you to kill the Broken Hounds, they're so weird and flavorful. Like my players, not my characters, were totally in love with Silene Basin. They thought it was such a weird place. They were trying to, you know, they were so intrigued by the different pools of water and what color they were. And, you know, I love that, you know, when they have to go see the woman who deals with illnesses of the brain, you know, she, you know, look for the sign with the brain on it. It's not painted on. It's a big, weird looking brain that has been nailed to a wooden sign.
That, I know, I love that.
Oh my gosh, I loved it so much. So, yeah, I feel like the Broken Hounds thing was a little let downy, kind of, compared to all of that weirdness and delight. But yeah, you can definitely modify it yourself.
Yeah, I almost wonder if that encounter was intended as kind of a touchstone for players that are familiar with like D&D type games, to like just give you a kind of, you know, what you see is what you get kind of encounter
that
amidst
might have
all
been
this
it.
Weirdness.
Yeah.
Awesome. Yeah, I was a big fan of Silene Basin, and I have a little sheet of notes here, and I wanted to mention it because even if you don't run this adventure, Silene Basin is an awesome little town that you
Absolutely.
Could use. Do you remember the pools? Do you want to tell us about the pools? Because those were pretty cool.
I'd have to look it up specifically.
I just remember there were different colored pools, and they had some kind of like restorative properties. Mm-hmm. Like you'd go in the water, and it would like I think there were nanites in the water that would kind of like cure you if you had a disease or something like that.
You're totally right.
Yeah. And so the whole town is kind of based around that. So there's all these like little shops with all these like holistic cures and herbalists and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah, absolutely. And one of the encounters is that I really liked is sort of the A Night in Town section.
Oh, yeah.
So, you know, you've gotten the stuff for Sierra to be healed, however this crazy brain lady is going to do it, and so you have sort of a night before that all gets resolved. And so my players were, you know, they wanted to go into sort of a tavern that was there, and you know, I included some fun little NPC interactions that gave more clues about what was happening in Embered Peaks. And and so, you know, while they were in the bar, you know, people come screaming out of out from the street, and something, you know, bugs have crawled through the black pool. Mm-hmm. And that like really shook my characters up, I think. Yeah. My players, because they were, you know, they're like, okay, we're in this great healing town, we've got danger in front of us and danger behind, but everything's cool now, we just have to hang out in a tavern. And that really was a great moment for keeping the danger level high and also weirdness. And, you know, a bunch of them had gotten in the pools earlier that day to get the healing bonus, right?
Cause it, yeah.
Yeah, so they were all like, oh, gosh, I was in that pool.
Oh, shit.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think that could easily become one of those red herrings that I think Numenera will become famous for.
Oh, my gosh. Red herrings. This whole adventure, my players were, by the end of it, they had made so many weird connections between tiny elements or tiny details I had dropped. They had this whole like conspiracy theory about, you know, who Borogal was and how his prison had something to do with the reservoirs of the healing water that came from Silene Basin, and something's happening there, and we have to work with Borogal later to figure out what's happening with the healing waters. And I was like, okay.
That's awesome.
And I just sort of kept quiet and nodded, like, next time on Numenera.
Yeah. Next week on Numenera.
Yeah.
Yeah, that actually reminds me of something I wanted to say about the Wandering Walk that I forgot is it was talking in the adventure, a lot of the adventure hooks that it gives you for the players to choose from, you know, are reasons that they would be on this Wandering Walk pilgrimage. And a lot of people of the Ninth World do it for, you know, religious or spiritual reasons, like, you know, like people do pilgrimages in our world. Mm-hmm. And, you know, that may not be appropriate for any of your players, depending on, you know, their character concepts. But a lot of times it seems like in Numenera, the player characters are, you know, you have the common people of the Ninth World who just believe that the Numenera is magic, and they have all these superstitious and religious beliefs, and every, you know, community you go to has some new crazy religion that they follow. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the PCs tend to be more like scientific or more, you know, trying to actually study and understand the Numenera themselves. Mm-hmm. And I, you know, a good motivation for a PC to be on the Wandering Walk is to look for Numenera. A lot of people put in their character concept something to do with, you know, I want to find Numenera and study, you know, this ancient technology. And I think that the Wandering Walk probably would take you to a lot of very interesting places with some very cool Numenera going on. So that's a good motivation for like your nanos and whatnot in the party.
Yeah, for a long-term motivation too. Yeah, that would definitely work. I was worried when I saw the Wandering Walk because before I had read the adventure, I read on some forum somebody sort of reviewing it, and they were like, oh, the Wandering Walk, it doesn't make any sense. I don't know how to explain it to my players. But my players just, you know, they were just willing to accept that it's some weird mystery and maybe we could figure out more about it, but they were sort of content to have it be weird and sort of inexplicable on why it exists the way it does, or at least currently inexplicable. So I think it wasn't a problem at all in the way that I thought it might be. The players were like, okay, there's a Wandering Walk. It's weird. Let's go along it and try to discover stuff. So they took it really in stride.
Yeah, and there's a great campaign idea right there. You know, your characters want to actually map the Wandering Walk and,
yeah.
And actually be able to say, this is where it goes, and this is the route, and this is where it ends up. And
yeah, cartography campaign.
Yeah, I love it. Cartography/naturalist campaign.
Yes. Because
you got to study everything you meet along the way, right?
That is tempting. I could run that campaign. I would love to.
I would love to play in that campaign. So if you run it, let me know.
Awesome. Definitely. So after Silene Basin, I'm very curious to see how you ran Embered Peaks and sort of the you know, actual meaning of Borgal for your wife.
Yeah.
So
yeah, that was, you know, I'm having a hard time remembering now. How it went. I do know that she managed to deal with Borgal in like a non-violent manner, mm-hmm. which is really good because she was all by herself. And I think even with a party of six or more players, if they're first tier and they go against Borgal in combat, I think it's going to be pretty rough for them.
Yeah.
What happened with your players? Did they fight Borgal or how did they deal with it?
Yeah, so they were so how I ran, you know, sort of before they even got to the place where Borgal was, when they got to Embered Peaks, it was like, you know, high tension. Everyone there is sort of gone totally insane. You know, they have I had a GM intrusion where some crazy dude with, you know, tons of weapons, you know, on every conceivable part of his body starts, you know, yelling at them and sort of just being a crazy paranoid person at them. And they, luckily, one of the glaives sort of, you know, also heavily armed to the teeth, just, you know, kind of talked this guy down. And so I think that sort of set them on they were very, you know, careful as they approached it. And so they sort of snuck up to the spot where the Forum of the Dead, I think, where the resurrection machine was said to be held. And they got in, and you know, they sort of talked their way past the clerk in front, and they go down. And what they decided to do, so I had been, so none of them were telepathic, and I was really nervous. They were just all going to, you know, TPK on me because they stupidly tried to attack the machine.
Right.
I was really, really nervous. But they had kind of known that something is happening telepathically from Sierra. And I had, like, sprinkled, you know, I have the cipher deck. I had pulled out every vaguely telepathic-related cipher I could find. And I, like,
oh, yeah.
I was making sure they were like littered. And you know, I tried to make it make sense because the lady who studies the brain had a couple that they gave, she gave them, and stuff like that. So they had some ciphers which allowed them to sort of try to interact with the Borogal. And fortunately, they, you know, I said, you know, he was screaming and seemed in pain anytime they tried to interact with him. And, you know, what they ended up to, so there were sort of three outcomes. They could just try to kill him. They could try to, like, shut down the machine with that little, like, device that the crazy sort of Aeon Priesty guy in the basement, killing all the other Devoirs, gave them.
So that could shut it down.
Yeah. Or you could like try to save him, and there was like a switch in back if he told you where to go. And so they ended up like saving him, and I really had to rush this scene because it was like 5 hours and we were all supposed to go 4. And so I was trying to wrap up. But they ended up, you know, with Borogal as a petrified brain that could telepathically interact with them, which is awesome.
Yeah.
And could be very game breaking if you weren't careful about it. Because he's, you know, presumably from a different age. But, you know, they were really thrilled to have him and sort of wanted to take him on their future adventures. And again, they were trying to figure out whether he would know what was happening with Silene Basin's water reservoirs and where they're coming from. So that's sort of how they ended up the thing. But I had to rush the end really a lot. So I think I'm just glad that they were a little sympathetic for him. Because I think he's a really tragic character.
Yeah, I remember now that my wife actually used the tool to like free him from the machine. And it's kind of a cool, I guess is he an artifact or does it, I don't remember if it
defines him in such a way.
But it's kind of cool if they end up with that little petrified brain, because if I remember right, he can also basically kind of act as a translator.
Oh, you're right. Because
he can telepathically communicate with anything intelligent. So he can kind of, if you encounter something like a Kalova, for instance, that you can't communicate with, he can kind of be like a translator, which is pretty cool. And one thing I thought was really interesting is you can also use him to like recharge an artifact.
Oh, yeah.
But then he's gone. So I thought it would be really interesting, especially if you're starting a campaign with this adventure, if the PCs end up with him, to see like how do they deal with that? Do they end up considering him a friend and they don't want to like basically kill him to power an artifact, or do they just callously power an artifact and do away with this person?
It would be fun to give them a broken artifact of some really great power and see what, you know, sort of engineer this like moral choice for them. I see in the description now that he would act as a translator and doesn't have, you know, knowledge of the current world. So yeah, I think that would actually work really well in a campaign and could be very fun for, you know, at any point, do we sacrifice him to recharge an important artifact?
Yeah, especially if you have some players that are all about solving as many of the mysteries in the Ninth World as they can, because he would be an awesome tool for that.
Yeah.
Because they could communicate with things that normally they would never be able to communicate with.
Mm-hmm.
So you brought up something that I wanted to point out that I didn't realize until I was in it, is that you really... until he's either defeated or rescued, your players can't communicate with Borogal unless they have some kind of like telepathic ability.
Right.
So I was looking through the foci, and the only ways I could find that they could do it is if you have someone with the command's mental powers focus, they can do it. Or if you had someone with the talk to machines focus, they could do it, but they couldn't do it until tier 3.
Wow, and, really?
Yeah, so I think your idea of sprinkling some ciphers in that give them telepathic ability is like a great way to kind of mitigate that, unless you have someone with command's mental powers.
Yeah, definitely. And, you know, I justified it to myself because, you know, I had them, you know, the woman who studies the brain and helped Sierra out with her Beal, give them some supplies and of that nature. But yeah, I had pulled out all the cipher cards that had anything to do with it. And I'm like, okay, I need to make sure that they have one of these by the time they get to the end, because I think that was just such a cool part of the plot, is, you know, Borregaal as a person. I think it would be, I really wanted them to interact with him. So.
Yeah, and considering this could be the first Numenera adventure that players play, I think it's a great way to kind of show them, you know, there are multiple ways to deal with threats in Numenera. It's not just combat. But if they don't have that telepathic ability, that's really the only option they have, mm-hmm. because they can't communicate with them or figure out what's going on. So, and if it is the first adventure, you know, they have their ciphers that they start out with too. So you can always give one or two players a cipher that way too, that could let them communicate with him.
Yeah, that's a good point.
Yeah, that's something I've only just recently started learning is to kind of look ahead in adventures and see if there's any, I don't know what you call it, like kind of a bottleneck like that, where it's like, okay, for the PCs to have this option, they need to have this ability. And if no one in your group has that ability, you know, give them a cipher a little time before that could do the trick, and hopefully they don't use it before then.
Right. And I think it's pretty rare in the adventures I've read that kind of, sort of thing happens. And, like, this adventure, you know, could entirely be run and still be satisfying by defeating the machine, never having talked to it, and letting all these people go back to not, you know, to being sane. So that would be one satisfying way, but personally, I just wanted to see it all unfold with them actually interacting with him. But yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. I agree on both counts. Mm-hmm. So yeah, if you are interested in the PCs getting to the heart of this matter, then yeah, they'll need some kind of telepathic ability.
Yeah.
But I mean, part of Numenera is all these unsolved mysteries around you. So if they can't, you know, that's cool too, because then they'll never exactly know what was going on, and that's kind of cool too.
Yep. Still in nature of the game, so it works out.
And yeah, it seems like at the end of this, depending how your players deal with the situation, they could be anything from heroes of the town to being chased out with pitchforks and torches or anywhere in between.
Oh, man. Oh, one thing I wanted to add, just sort of as an impression of this adventure and most of Monte Cook's adventures, is that, and I won't go into this too much, but... you know, the gender diversity of this adventure is great, you know, and I was really disappointed when I realized that I personally, as a GM, need to be better about instituting that. You know, I'm used to playing games that are mostly male-dominated in their adventures and NPCs and everything, and players, and so every NPC that I came up with was male, but there's still, like, the players seemed pretty satisfied because of all the females that are built into the adventure, and so they thought it was a pretty good, diverse group, but, you know, I'm just inspired by, you know, Monte Cook Games' design standards of having a good, diverse group of NPCs, and so I need to get better about sort of keeping up with that when I'm creating my own NPCs.
Yeah. I've taken this new setting in this new game as a chance to kind of create the world I'd like to live in.
Yes.
So I try very hard to present my ninth world as a place where, you know, no one thinks twice about having a woman glaive save the town from the huge monster. And no one thinks twice about some dude staying home and watching your kids while you go off to do what you got to do. Yeah.
So. And some of the play podcasts that I've been listening to, they tend to have like this element of chivalry, like for PC characters or NPCs, like, oh, we must protect the women.
Right.
And if my players do that, the way I want to run this setting is that it would be seen as weird for people to do that, to be chivalrous in that sense. Like, you know, I want it to be like for some reason you felt like you needed to protect all brown haired people. Like it would be that sort of weird thing to do. Like, okay, if you want to be nice to a certain subset of people, go ahead. It's just an odd thing to base it on because there is no, you know, power dynamic between men and women in this world. So I think it'll be fun to see how my eventual players, you know, in a campaign would deal with that.
Yeah, I think that's a great way to handle it. Mm-hmm. Although I have to say, brown-haired people are pretty awesome. I mean,
they do the saving. I understand.
Yeah, and I don't know. I think a lot of people maybe picture the Ninth World as kind of like a medieval type setting, mm-hmm. but I tend to picture it more even as like a Dark Age type setting. And you know, in that kind of world, I mean, practical is the most important thing. You know, people are just fighting to survive. And I mean, the idea of chivalry, I just don't think even has a place in a world like that. People would be way too practical. You know, maybe the super rich would have some idea like right. that. But
yeah, that's a really good point.
So Darcy, did you notice any, I guess you could say, pitfalls in the adventure, any places where a new GM might get tripped up or something to think about ahead of time before you get to it?
I think we've discussed the ones that I wanted to talk about, which was that if you want the ability of the players to speak with Borregaul, then you need to make sure one of them has, you know, the focus that allows it, or sprinkle in Cypher so that they have that ability should they choose to use it. And then, you know, I think the Broken Hound's little combat could use some injected flavor of your own if you were going to run it. And then just that sort of the context for it, I think it would work great as starting a campaign. And I think it does work as like a one shot, but it would require some modification and probably some hustling your players to really get it into a decent time window. And you know, but it's built pretty modularly. So I think you could get around that without too much difficulty. I think those are the only things that I really wanted to recommend to people who are going to run it.
Yeah. And if you're not on any kind of a time limit, depending, you know, what red herrings the players chase after, you know, you could get quite a few gaming sessions out of this adventure if your players are really into investigating everything that they can.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. And, you know, if you are a new GM and this is the first thing you're running, consider just adding something of your own to it, whether it's an encounter or a creature or adding like another layer or another subplot. And I don't know. I actually started out GMing running my own adventures. I GM'd for a long, long time before I ever ran any kind of published adventure. And so that might kind of color my experience. But to me, I've actually found it easier. I find it easier to run an adventure I came up with myself than to run a published adventure. Because if I've come up with it myself, I kind of know it inside and out. Where, you know, with a published adventure, I'm constantly like, oh, you want to know this? Well, let me look and see, because I don't remember and I have to look it up.
Right.
So yeah, you know, give it a shot. Throw your own little flavor into it, and you may find that that's your favorite part of the adventure, and maybe the next time you're going to create something all your own. Who knows?
Good advice. Yeah.
So, Darcy, you've run this, and you've run the Nightmare Switch, right?
Correct.
But not the Vortex yet.
Not the Vortex yet, though. I think I'll get around to it.
Okay, awesome. Awesome. Yeah, I just realized today when I was looking over this that there's still, I think, one or two adventures in the core book that I haven't even read yet.
Oh, yeah. I don't know that I've read the next two either. Seed Ship and something else.
I know one of them I haven't read is called The Three Sanctums, I think. Hmm. So, and I have the Vortex, but I haven't read it yet.
The Vortex is good because it can really be sprinkled in anywhere.
Cool. Mm-hmm. Well, I'll have to read it.
Yeah.
And yeah, the let's see, one of the other ones in the core book, like you said, is Seed Ship, and that is one that I read that I thought was kind of cool and could probably be done as a one shot too.
Ooh, I'll have to read it.
Yeah, what about the Nightmare Switch? Is that like a one shot adventure or is it longer?
So that one lends itself even better to a one shot like constraint than I think the Vortex does.
Okay.
So yeah, that one is just really, it's just like 6 pages of text maybe, but it usually fills like about 4 hours, maybe 3.5 every time I've run it. And, it's not quite railroady, but players usually figure out the best way to go quickly. And, what's nice is that like the Beale of Borgol, it has them, you know, climbing over things and doing social interactions with a little bit of combat. It's another, you know, good, and it's got a lot of, you know, weird little bits, like weird elements that I think are also a good introduction to the Ninth World. And so that's why I liked it a lot. But yeah. And that one's awesome. A Kickstarter only, I think. But it's good. I can't wait for even more adventures to come out. I'm always, you know, looking forward to those.
So you were a Kickstarter backer. Do you remember or know, did they say that will always be Kickstarter only, or is it possible they'll release it later for everybody else?
I haven't heard, but yeah, I'm not sure. It's a good little adventure, so I kind of hope that they maybe eventually open it up for purchase, but we'll see.
Yeah, that'd be a great glimmer.
Yeah, definitely.
All right, Darcy. Well, thank you very much for talking with us about the Beale of Borgol. And hopefully you'll come back in the future and talk about some of these other adventures you've run.
Awesome. Yeah, I'd love to. Thanks so much for having me on.
Yeah, anytime.
GM Intrusions Wrap Up.
That's going to wrap it up for episode 16 of GM Intrusions. Thank you, everyone, for coming along for the ride. If you would like to contact me, you can email me at lexstarwalker@gmail.com. Please follow me on Twitter @LexStarwalker, and you can find the show notes for this show at starwalkerstudios.com/GM Intrusions. Once again, I'd like to thank Darcy for joining me and sharing her GM wisdom about the Beale of Borgol. You can follow her on Twitter @DarcyLRoss. Thank you all for listening and for being part of the Numenera and the Strange and the GM Intrusions community. You guys make this all possible. If you would like to contribute to this show by sending an MP3 or a WAV, feel free to do so and email it to me. Also, feel free to submit ideas for the antagonist and protagonist segment. If there's a specific critter in Numenera, the core book or the bestiary that you really like and you'd like to hear me talk about. Thank you again for my listeners who have left reviews on iTunes, please stop by the iStore and leave a review for the podcast. It will help new listeners find the podcast. So again, thank you all for listening. I'm Lex Starwalker, and this has been a GM Intrusion.
This has been a Starwalker Studios production, your source for quality science fiction and fantasy podcasts.
This episode's music provided by Ish, Cloudwalker, Renfield, and Transboy. Please see the show notes for more details at starwalkerstudios.com.
I'm awesome!